All right, this is the New Glarus Brewing Podcast with Dan Carey. I am Scott May. Welcome back to it. We are very happy today to be sitting down and talking, and very happy that this podcast has seemed to find an audience. How are you doing today, Dan?
I'm doing all right.
Yeah, me too. And today, I'm really excited about the topic we're going to be talking about because it's a beer I really enjoy. But it's also a style of beer I really enjoy. And we're going to be talking about Two Women, the beer, which sort of occupies the space in your lineup as sort of the third year-round non-fruit beer, right?
Yep.
So can you tell us a little bit about when you were first coming up with this beer you wanted to do, how it came about, and what was sort of the impetus or your inspiration behind this when you first started thinking about it?
Well, you know, I've always been a fan of Munich-style Helles beers and Franconian, what I call Franconian land beers. They're usually a little bit maltier and a little bit darker in color than a traditional Munich Helles. It's always been one of my favorite styles of beer. So this beer came about as started as kind of a one-time Helles beer to make. And it was made with malt from the Weiermann Malting Company in Bamberg, Germany, which is in Franconia. And hence the name Two Women for the owner of the malt house, Sabina Weiermann, and for Deb. So that's kind of where it started. It started as a one-off, and then Deb really liked it and liked the concept, and so we put it into our year-round lineup.
I remember, I'm trying to remember my history on this, but I have a very vivid memory of, I was going to a friend's house on the east side, and it must have been mid-2000s, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And we were heading over there, like, oh, we're empty-handed, we got to stop and get like a six-pack or something to bring over to this dinner party. And asked the guy at Vic Pierce, you know, oh, do you have anything you'd recommend that's new? And he goes, oh, there's this new beer from New Glarus, it's called Two Women. And I remember buying the six pack and taking it over to a friend's house and sitting out in their back porch and drinking this beer. And even then, not knowing a lot about beer or this particular style of beer, just being sort of taken by how subtle yet like really impactful it was. It was just it was a beer drinker's beer, but it had such like a smooth, like almost depth of flavor that it kind of blew my hair back. So here you're talking about this as sort of a one-off. That raises a couple questions in my mind. First, was sort of a Helles lager like a typical brewery one-off that people were sort of putting out at this time, or was
No, not at all. The problem with a craft brewing business is that when people think of craft beer, they instantly think of ales, and they usually think of pale ales and IPAs or maybe a strong stout. But the idea, particularly when we came out with that beer, the idea of a Helles was really not really on people's radar. Mm-hmm. So that's why it was one off, because sometimes we do beers just because it's fun. It's something that I'd like to do. Yeah. And, anybody that's, had a chance to walk around Munich, the old town of Munich, and drink Helles beer, which is really where it was invented. It's a beer made for drinking.
Yeah.
And, that's why I did it, just for fun.
Just for fun. Yeah. And so when you had people out to sort of, was this the first of the R&D series, or was this?
No, I think we were making, spontaneously fermented R&D beers and fruited sour beers before then.
So when people came to try this R&D, were they sort of taken aback by it being just, or not just, but a Helles lager, or did they kind of understand like this, there was a special reason for this?
Yeah, we only sold it out of the brewery in 0.5-liter bottles, German, what are called, Euro bottles. Mm-hmm. And, I think the people that bought it understood what it was. And, I think beer aficionados got it and were really happy with it.
So one of the interesting things I think about Two Women, and this might just be in my mind and exist nowhere else, but when I read a lot about beer now, of course, I'm doing this with you and I've been working around here for a couple of years in other capacities. But I often see people say, you know, the great debate between Spotted Cow or Moon Man. And I'm always like, why aren't you guys talking about two women? This is just like a, like to me, a dark horse contender for probably my favorite year round non-fruited beer. Can you talk to me a little bit about how it was received going year round and, you know, what you like about this beer and what sort of went into the brewing of it, I guess.
Well, I guess, boy, that's a lot. I guess, first of all, what the beer really is all about is, you know, it is our third biggest seller. So, it's a relatively popular beer and it's by far Deb's favorite beer. Mm-hmm. And so, that's one of the reasons why we've kept it around. She loves it and there is a following for it.
Yeah.
It's certainly not as popular as Spotted Cow. And part of the problem is that there's only so much bandwidth in people's minds and on tap knobs that are available. So, unfortunately I wish it was on tap everywhere like Spotted Cow, but it's not. Last night, for example, Deb, cooked some, bratwurst from Bavarian Kitchen and, that's really when Two Women Shines is when it's coupled with food, particularly, you know, things like Wiener Schnitzel or
pork knuckle.
Yeah, exactly. although I don't know if she's ever cooked pork knuckle that I can remember, but yes, typical, Germanic, food. It's with hearty food, it goes really, really well. It complements and balances. So, I think that it's a beer that exists in that middle ground of just good drinkability. And sometimes it gets lost in the chatter of IPAs and the like, but I'm hoping that eventually people will, start looking at beer more for its sessionability, its drinkability, and not for its, loud impact.
Well, yeah. And I think, something like, and I certainly have a deep, deep affinity for IPAs, double IPAs.
Yeah, sure. So do I.
Fruited sours, all of that stuff. But there is something to be said when the, you know, sort of the knob gets turned down a little bit and you have to start sort of parsing these subtle flavors you're experiencing. You can't necessarily define it right away on the palate, you know? And I think Two Women to me serves that perfect middle beer for when I just want to have a beer that I can think
right.
about.
That's
and enjoy.
Exactly right. It's a beer that is like, you know, I don't want to work too hard. I just want to have a beer. that's really what it's all about.
And I was talking with Deb in sort of preparation for this. And that was the sentiment, you know, she had is that, to her, it reminded her of a beer you would sneak a sip of off your dad in like the mid-70s.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
And I thought that was like a perfect way to describe that. But we are talking about a beer called Two Women, and there is a reason for that. In conceptualizing this beer, you partnered up with, as you said, this malt house in Munich.
In Bamberg. Yep.
That was run by a woman. And of course, Nuglaris was founded by Deb. What struck you as sort of important of that? Or was it just sort of how it shook out and sort of happenstance?
For me, it was just kind of how it shook out.
Yeah.
I didn't plan it. But the funny thing is that beer really, it was influenced by three women, but Deb's not going to change the name. So of course, it was fortuitous that the recipe by chance was, of course, Nuclearis Brewing is, our founder and president is a woman. Mm-hmm. President of Weiermann Malting in Bamberg is also a woman. She is fourth generation, owner of this malt house. And her daughter, is soon to take over. She'll be fifth generation.
Wow.
And, they are, a very, very successful malt house. Probably nearly every brewer in the world uses at least some of their malt in their beers, and which is a huge feat for a family run malt house in Bamberg, Germany. They're very quality led, but Sabina Weiermann has taken this. She's been running this malt house a little bit longer than we've had our brewery, and her father before her had the business, and since she's taken over, she's built it a hugely successful, made great gains. And so she's a very, very hardworking and clever business person in maltster. And so her and Deb, you know, they're Facebook friends and they're close. They're somewhat kindred spirits.
Yeah.
And then there's actually a third business. Our hops come from Goshi Farms, which is in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. And that is a fourth generation farm. A hop farm. They grow grapes and they grow grains, but hops are their business. And Gail Goshi is there's three siblings, and one of them, Gail Goshi, is the person we deal with, and she's also she's a wonderful hop farmer. She does a great job. She grows Hallertau hops for us. Hallertau Middelfru. Mm-hmm. She calls them Abiqua, but she's very, very clever. So it was fortuitous that the three people that influenced this recipe were women.
Yeah.
And so hence the name Two Women. But from Deb's point of view, historically, brewing was done in the home, or in small taverns, small hotels. And it's a cooking process, making beer. So yeah. It was usually done by somebody in the home or in the restaurant. And oftentimes that was women. So since it's a cooking process, historically it was done by women. And that really didn't start to change until the Industrial Revolution, when brewing went left sort of the house or the hotel or tavern and became industrialized. Mm-hmm. And then it started to move into more of a male-dominated world. And ironically, even in some of the Slavic countries, in Russia, in Ukraine, Romania, most of the brewmasters or brewmistresses are women. Mm-hmm. So certainly women have had a huge impact on the technology and history of brewing. Yeah. That, of course, has been forgotten. So Deb wanted to remind people that this is not a male-dominated industry, or it shouldn't be, or it wasn't.
Yeah.
And so this was, for her, some recognition of that fact.
Yeah, sort of like, you know, as restaurants open and people start getting recognized and chefs, it becomes very male, but historically, if you look at the total of recorded history, these industries were not male dominated by, or they weren't even industries. They were essentially things you made for the home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Beer was just like anything else that was cooked for the home.
Well, that's really interesting to me, because it's, you know, because then you start thinking about the implications of that and just style progression and who gets credit for these styles having progressed. And it's like, well, if we're just going to lop off, you know, everything pre-industrial,
1600 or 1700. Yeah.
Well, no, I think to me, it seems like a very good reason to make a beer to remind people specifically of that. As you said, this is a Helles lager. Can you run us through a little bit of your history with Helles lagers and how you conceptualize them and things like that?
Well, you know, a Helles lager should be made with sort of a European style malt, a malt that's a little bit richer in character than a typical North American lager malt, and what are called noble hops.
Yeah.
The term noble hops refers to more or less landrace hops that were not bred, but that were selected in the field in Germany and Czech Republic, and maybe you could argue in France and in Slovenia, but these supposedly, I don't know who came up with the term noble hops, but there's a hunch that it was a kind of a marketing ploy to differentiate them from the more modern hops. But so those are really
sort of like the heirloom of its time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And as I said before, their lager beers in general are a relatively new invention. Probably only since about the 1500s have lager beers really been brewed, and it's kind of a kind of a fortuitous history that brought us to the modern times. But lager brewing really came, the way that we think of lager brewing really came into existence in the 1800s. Through the 1800s, the large brewers of Munich really nailed how traditional lager beer should be made. And that traditional way of brewing is what I like. It's fascinating to me, and how this beer is designed to be beers of Munich are generally historically malt forward. They were very much dark until probably 130 years ago. They were mostly dark beer. So the pale Helles beer is a relatively new invention.
Yeah, so that sort of explains why it was important for you to have two women have sort of the more auburn color, I guess.
Yeah, I would say it's a light color. It's not pale like a Pilsner. Yeah. It's not as pale as a Helles. In fact, Helles means pale. So it has always leaned more towards the Franconian, the northern Bavarian tradition of a little bit darker, richer, maltier beer. You find in villages in the north of Bavaria, what it's called Niederbayern or Franconia, this style of beer that's malt forward and a little bit darker in color.
Yeah. And like I said, for me, I wanted to talk about this just because I frankly love this beer so much, and I wanted to know more about it. And in speaking with you a little bit before we got started, you had mentioned a friend of yours that you liked to talk to about lager brewing, your mentor, and that sort of thing. Did you want to speak on him a little bit?
Yeah, I'm a little bit off today because a couple of days ago, a very close friend of mine passed away. So I'm kind of in mourning, kind of bummed right now.
Feeling that a little bit.
Yeah, he was a very, very close friend and my mentor, really. I've known him for close to 40 years, and he was 97 years old, but he was the lead professor at Weihenstephan University near Munich, Professor Ludwig Narzis. He was, before that, he was brewmaster at Lohenbrau in Munich. Wow. So he was a very kind and generous brewer and researcher, scientist, and probably has had I can't think of anybody in the world who's had a larger influence on how modern beers brewed, modern brew house design. The yeast that most brewers use, 3470, was selected by him his PhD project. And so he was a titan in the brewing industry. He was a good friend of mine, helped me over the years. And I used to bring two women when I'd go visit him. He lived in Freising near Munich, and he would say that how much it was exactly like a Munich beer. And so we talked about the finer points of brewing this beer and brewing lager beer in general. And of course, he's being a professor of a Bavarian brewing school, was very, very keen on the Reinheitsgebot and the purity of brewing, the simplicity, and traditional brewing methods. And in fact, he used to joke and say that he and I should collaborate and make a beer called Two Boys to compliment two women. He was a big fan of Deb. Mm-hmm. It's a loss to me, lost a good friend, and he's educated many generations of brewers that have gone on to run breweries and malt houses all over the world, from Japan to Africa to Europe, everywhere.
Well, yeah. First of all, I'm sorry for your loss. I know how tough it can be when you lose someone close to you.
And, yeah.
But what a legacy to leave behind to the world.
Yeah. I'm 97 years. He had a good life. He was very vibrant. He walked even up till the end. He walked an hour a day at 97. He loved a good beer. He drank at least one beer every day, being a good Bavarian.
Good Bavarian, good German.
So I think he did well. He made it a long way. He was only really the last month when things went downhill. He got Corona, COVID.
No.
So I think that was tough.
Well, I'm glad we were able to discuss him here on this podcast. And you know, Ludwig Narzis sounds like he left his impression on this beer in particular, but also yep. the brewing industry yep. in general. So it's a loss, but and I'm glad you got the opportunity to speak about him. So one of the things that kind of strikes me about your personality and being just sort of as focused as you are on the beer, as focused as you are on crafting the beer, is sometimes the names of the beer sort of go, you know, past you just a little bit.
Yeah.
And when we talked about Totally Naked a couple of times, I think you said something to the effect of like, you know, in my mind, I'm talking about a beer that's just stripped of.
Yeah, like singing a cappella.
And Deb was telling me a story about the first time, one of the first times she was bringing, I guess, two women around to one of the festivals in Milwaukee. And you said, oh, how'd it go? How'd they like it? And they go, well, you know, I got the usual jokes, two women totally naked. And you said something to the effect of, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Like you said, so focused on the idea of, you know, Deb and Sabina Weierman and Gail Goshi, that the idea of any, you know, shall we say, sexual connotations of Totally Naked and two women, which, you know, is kind of offensive. It hadn't even really, I'm embarrassed to say, hadn't crossed my mind. So when she told me that, I was a little bit taken aback, maybe a little bit outraged, because it's, beer is, for me, okay, beer is a food. It's a social lubricant, but it's also a magical thing.
Yeah.
And there's some reverence around it.
Yeah.
At least there should be.
Well, especially with this beer and sort of the story of how it came about and why it came about. And
well, you know, and also the thing is that in a lot of ways, the marketing of beer in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s was so overtly sexual and misogynist that it alienated at least 50% of the population, because I can understand why a lot of people wouldn't want to drink beer. And I mm-hmm. think that marketing towards a male 21 to 25-year-old with juvenile BS advertising has dumbed down beer, and the name Totally Naked, Two Women has nothing to do with that.
Genre. That sort of bent in how beer has been advertised.
Yeah, it's set us back. That and Prohibition have really set back American brewing.
Well, yeah, and then you start thinking about, you know, especially in the last 10 years, that people are becoming more cognizant of, quote, male-dominated industries and things like that. And you have things cropping up out of necessity, like the Pink Boot Society and all of that stuff to sort of promote getting women into beer. It sounds like from your point of view, you know, the way beer was marketed and the way beer was advertised sort of made these things a necessity moving forward. You know, to sort of roll out the welcome mat, I guess.
Well, you could say that it's somewhat altruistic, but it's also... The problem is that when you alienate a large group of society, of the workforce, of mm-hmm. talent, of brains, that feel like I don't see myself here, then you lose. Mm-hmm. You lose all of that talent. And if you look at our country as a tribe, or the way that we work together, when we alienate people, we lose so much talent.
Yeah.
And it's shameful to not allow people to contribute, no matter whether they have X or Y chromosomes. Doesn't really matter if they're smart and are willing to chip in. You know, that's great. We have, for example, in our brewery, I think we have probably 13 different departments, you know, from gift shop to warehouse. And of those 13 departments, I think the team leaders, I think six of them are female. Mm-hmm. And that's not any sort of plan. It's just that the most qualified person was given the job. Yeah. And so we're really blessed to have hardworking people, irregardless of who they are, where they come from, or any of that stuff. So, you know, my mother was born in 1923, and she grew up in a time, and, you know, I was born in 1960, which was certainly a time of turmoil, but, you know, I learned early from her a sense of outrage of the misjustice that the world was set up in a way that was not allowing a lot of people to succeed. And that that was outrageous to her. And so I learned very early that it's really not how the world should be. People should be judged on their skills, not on, like I said, their chromosomes or their whatever.
Yeah. Well, and yeah. And making sure, you know, fostering just a environment where people feel welcome should just be like the base level.
Well, yeah.
You know, just the basic of human decency, yeah. I guess.
There's so many talented people, so many people that, in our company, we have over 120 employees and, so much talent and clever people that it's really nice to be able to keep that pool as large as possible.
Yeah. So we've been talking about two women, which if I have not made abundantly clear yet, is absolutely one of my favorite beers. And I'm serious. I think it is like a dark horse contender for my favorite beer just around here. Cause
it, you're making me thirsty.
I know. I'm making myself thirsty. But we, I think we've covered it pretty well in depth. One of the cool things about doing this podcast with you and, you know, frankly, being the guy who all the email comes to, and if you do have a question or just want to share an anecdote or a story with us, you can email me at smay at newglariusbrewing.com, is that I get to field the questions from people and sometimes gets stories out of them. And we had a guy write in by the name of Dave Godek, who relayed a story about being in Helena, Montana in the mid 80s and thinking he met you at your brewery. He was a pilot on a layover and he was able to borrow a car and go to what he assumed was the Kessler Brewery and just sort of knocked on the door. And my favorite detail of the story is a guy answered the door in a hat that said, "Yeah, I'm the brewmaster," and gave this guy a tour. And then he had subsequently moved to Madison and got a tour from Deb here down in New Glarus in the mid 90s. But his question was, did you remember giving this tour, or was this you, or do you remember what Kessler was doing at that time and that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's he sent a really nice letter. That was a lot of fun to read. But I don't think it was me for a few reasons. I was at Kessler from 83 to 86. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I would have wore a hat that says, "Yeah, I'm brewmaster." That's not really not my style.
That's not your style.
I kind of try to stay below the radar.
Yeah. Although it would be a really cool hat to wear if you weren't a brewmaster.
Yeah, right.
Just wear it around.
Right. I do have a hat that says Montana Barley, but I don't have one that says, "Yeah, I'm the brewmaster." And the second thing was, he mentioned in his letter that this individual mentioned that they were going to be contract brewing mm-hmm. beer for a ski resort. And when I was there, we never did any contract brewing. So I think who we met was probably Julius Hummer. Mm-hmm. Julius took over after I left, and Julius's dad was one of the principals that started the Boulder Brewing Company in the infamous Goat Barn in Boulder, Colorado. It was one of the first craft breweries. So Julius had studied brewing in England and gone on to run Kessler Brewing, which changed its name to Montana Brewing because of Kessler Whiskey. But Kessler was an old brewery in the frontier town of Helena before Prohibition, and even up, I think, into the 50s, it was around. But the Deb did give him a tour at this brewery. So the world is a very small place. And ironically, Kessler Brewing Company in Helena in 83 was where Deb and I met. Mm-hmm. I was working as lead brewer, brewmaster there, and Deb was doing graphics and marketing. So that was, 40 years ago, and we're still pretty much doing the same thing. One of these days we'll get it figured out. But yeah, so that's where we met. I remember Horizon Air, I've flown Horizon Air. They flew in and out of Helena. And, but unfortunately I don't think it was me that gave the tour.
Yeah. I know what your Christmas present's going to be this year. It's a hat that says, yeah, I'm the brewmaster.
Yeah. Right. Right. Maybe those wings like they give to kids when they go on airplanes, you know, Horizon Air pilots wings or something.
Well, I think we might have time for one more question, and this one came in, and I think it might be a little apropos to this episode as well, since two women did start out in the R&D release category, and someone had wrote in asking about the bottles that the R&Ds come in, and what was the decision-making behind that, and I think their basic point was, well, it's kind of atypical for brewery one-off releases. You either see the big bombers or the like. So why the 500 milliliter?
Yeah, they're 500 milliliter. They're called the Euro Flasche or the Euro bottle.
Okay.
It's the old traditional bottle that was used in Germany, because nearly all bottles in Germany are returnable. So they have to be heavier glass. And as I've often said in the past and other subjects, that we try to go our own way. Mm-hmm. So that's why we don't have, you know, 750s or champagne bottles. We wanted to do something different.
Yeah.
And frankly, you know, from Depp's point of view, they do have a unique appearance. If you're somebody who's from Germany, they're very iconic, a nostalgic beer bottle that not all brewers use anymore. So that was one of the reasons, but we also make, beers in these bottles that are, over attenuating yeast like Brettanomyces. And what that means is yeast that can, continue to ferment and produce CO2. So a beer that might go into a bottle at say 2.7 volumes of CO2, theoretically, if you have Brettanomyces, it could significantly increase up to as much as 8 volumes, like champagne.
It's not like which they have a cutoff switch where they go.
Well, yeah, unfortunately not. So it was allowed a level of safety. Not that we'd ever want a beer that highly carbonated. I certainly would not do it on purpose. But if the yeast continues to eat and producing carbon dioxide, those thick bottles are robust enough to handle any excessive carbonation. So for me, making spontaneous beers, it was for safety reasons that I wanted to use it. So it was for the aesthetics, for safety, and also to be somewhat unique, because not many people are using that bottle for these types of beers. And it's very unique to have a sour, a Guzza or a sour beer in a German beer bottle, which is a little bit kind of maybe tongue in cheek, because it's our own way, and because we're not in Belgium, we're not in Germany, we're our own brewery. So we're going to find our own way. We're going to be our own selves and not try to emulate some, we're not trying to copy anybody.
Yeah. Well, and the listener pointed it out, and I tend to agree, and I didn't think about it till he did. It's, you know, you open a 750 of something, you need at least another person around.
Yeah, or that's right.
If you have a 500 milliliter, you can feel good about just being like, all right, I'm going to have a beer.
Yeah, you know, in a lot of ways, 500 milliliters is a standard serving in Germany. And for me personally, I mean, certainly I want to moderate my beer consumption, but 500 milliliters is about a perfect size.
Yeah.
355 mil, 12 ounces. As a little bit, you know, I'm a little bit wanting. I had a can of Two Women with our bratwurst last night, and really, you know, 12 ounces ain't just. I could probably go 500 milliliters would be better.
Yeah, for when you just want a beer and a half.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Well, cool. And as always, thank you for your time, Dan. And again, sorry for the loss of your friend.
Yeah, thank you. He will be missed.
He will be, he'll be missed. It sounds like his contribution to beer and brewing can't really be measured at this point.
No, it's huge. He's got many, many books and hundreds of scientific papers.
Well, research Dr. Ludwig Narcisse, and we will catch you guys next time. Thank you again for listening, and thank you for your time, Dan.
Thanks, Scott.